Live from KALW Studios in San Francisco, this is City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. With public health officials warning about the risks of indoor gatherings, tonight we'll explore some ways to get outdoors for some great hikes in the Bay Area and learn more about a project to document all the public stairways of San Francisco. We'll also have a conversation with Karen Seneferu, activist, artist, project lead, and co-curator for the exhibition The Black Woman is God, Reclaim, Reconfigure, Remember, which is showing at SOM Arts and the African American Art and Culture Complex. But first, we get the latest on the COVID-19 pandemic with our regular contributors, San Francisco Chronicle health reporter Aaron Alday and UCSF infectious disease specialist Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having us back.
It feels like a homecoming, Pache.
It does. It feels like it's been a while. Aaron, let's dive right in. COVID-19 was in the news even more than usual today. Governor Gavin Newsom had a press conference where he said California needs to pull the quote-unquote emergency brake because daily cases have doubled in the last 10 days, which is the fastest rate of increase we have ever seen. What does this mean for Bay Area counties?
So what this means is we're essentially, you know, issuing some new shutdowns, some new restrictions. At this point, as of tomorrow, only one county in the Bay Area will have indoor dining. So that's San Mateo County, which is kind of a little bit, it's become a little bit of the marker for the pandemic and restrictions, right? Like we kind of think about that as if indoor dining is allowed, then things are going okay. And when it's closed, that means they're not going very well. So they're not going well. We're definitely, you know, hearing from health officers, a lot of concern. I think the main concern is what we're seeing is that this wave that's been kind of crashing across the country has now reached the West Coast, has reached California. And we just need to be really aggressive at this early stage while cases are still, you know, somewhat low, but spiking really high, that this is the time to take that really aggressive action.
And would you say that Gavin Newsom's stance today was more proactive to get ahead of a growing problem, or are we in the midst of something that's really surging fast?
I would say more the latter. If you had asked that question last week, it felt more like a lot of the moves that we are seeing were proactive, but it seems like this is exploding so quickly that we're now more in the reactive stage. I mean, as you said yourself, and as the governor said, you know, we're seeing a bigger trend upward than at any other time in the pandemic, which is just not the place where you want to be. If you look at the charts, you look at the numbers, we were starting already at a larger baseline than we ever have, just in terms of where we had plateaued in September and October. And now we're seeing a much sharper increase than we have at any other time. So yeah, I think at this point, we're very much in the reactive, trying to really, you know, stave that off as best we can. And we're back in that phase of talking about not so much preventing the surge, it's already here, but really in that let's protect the hospitals, let's protect our healthcare workers phase of things.
And so where do you see restrictions going from here?
That's a good question. I think it's possible that we'll kind of keep in this zone, you know, at this point with almost, you know, I mean, I think 95% of the state, of the residents in the state are now in this most restrictive purple tier or will be as of tomorrow. You know, the next phase after that would be a back to shelter in place order, which I think everybody is trying to avoid at all costs. And I think there's a solid argument that we've learned we don't necessarily need to do that. That we can keep certain things open. And, you know, as long as people are masked, as long as people are, you know, keeping that social distance, that's sort of the way to handle things. But that being said, you know, we're gonna know in the next kind of week or two if this is working, this sort of, you know, lock everything down as best we can. And if, you know, we need to head into another shelter in place, which is not off the table. I mean, certainly, you know, the governor brought it up today as something he's trying to avoid. San Francisco health officer has said the same. So the fact they're even saying this is something we're trying to avoid, a shelter in place, I think is pretty striking.
Those three dreaded words.
Right.
It seems inevitable on some level because you're saying we're starting at a higher baseline, obviously, because we've been living with COVID since February and before that, likely. And then it sounds like the slope of the curve and the increase in cases is actually steeper than that which we saw earlier in the spring. So does are you getting a sense that this feels inevitable to you? Or do you really feel like there's still a chance here where we can bend the curve, as it were, without going to shelter in place again?
I do feel like there's a chance. I think, you know, we're going to keep a really close eye on two things, or a couple of things. One would be, you know, do we see that rate of increase? Because we're going to see cases increase. It takes a little while for these restrictions to work, to actually take effect. So we will see increase, but do we see that bending? Do we see that sort of slacking off a little bit? Do we see that positivity rate, you know, maybe inch down a little bit instead of inching up? But the most important thing really is those hospital numbers now. Where if we start, that's going to be, you know, when we really start potentially seeing shelter in place orders discussed, is if we see any movement towards putting a crunch on our hospital numbers. I think we will see no hesitation, certainly from the local counties in the Bay Area, and probably from the state too, in terms of just saying, okay, enough. Let's shut it down. So, and Thanksgiving is going to be a big issue too, of course.
Right, of course. And what do you make of the governor's even mentioning the possibility of curfew today, which is something we have not heard associated with the coronavirus before?
I think that's another sign of just, you know, how much he's trying to, both how much they're trying to avoid another shelter in place order, but also how much we've sort of learned about how this virus operates, and what are some of the tools that we can employ to prevent spread without going back into a shelter in place. So, you know, if we've identified that, you know, if we keep kind of certain businesses closed during certain hours, if we can sort of keep those sort of, you know, interactions, it's really to keep people from interacting with people outside of their household, right? So if we can, you know, find some way to control those, then that would be sort of what a curfew would be about. And that's just, you know, it's been, I think, shown to work in other countries and other places. The governor did say he's looking at other countries to see how effective those curfews have been. So I think it's just, you know, it's come up as, again, another tool that they can potentially deploy. And again, they're doing that for two reasons: to protect the hospitals, but also to avoid that shelter in place order.
So, Peter, turning to you, we see this second surge or third surge. I don't know how many surges we've had so far. I think we're going to have to count them again once this is all over. It's understandable that this would be happening again. It was predicted. Is the fact that it's going to potentially surge higher than the first wave have anything to do with the biology, the virology here? Or is this more connected to what I've been reading, which is that people have gotten tired of restrictions and have gotten looser and have just been gathering more and therefore have been spreading this virus?
Well, Pache, I think it's a little bit of everything, unfortunately. And that's why I think we're seeing these amazing asymptomatic sort of like exponential increases, because it's not only pandemic fatigue, and some people have recoined it pandemic you know, sort of indifference or pandemic, even resentment. That's one issue. But the other issues are, you know, it's colder, so it's just more probable that we're going to gather indoors. And I think the issue that we can't really control is, you know, the other states are exploding. And because we don't have a national strategy and we have porous borders, what is other people's problem in terms of surging becomes our problem eventually.
So going back to that point, Aaron, coronavirus infections are increasing everywhere. We just spoke about California, but they've been skyrocketing across the country. And it seems like whatever advantage the Bay Area had is eroding. There was an article in the Chronicle earlier, I believe today, stating how, you know, Northern versus Southern California. Northern California has had much more intense restrictions and more cautious lifting of those restrictions versus Southern California. Are we at a place where no matter what we did up until now, this is just the way it was just going to go and it was just a matter of time? Or could you see that there was a way that we could have avoided this?
It's a complicated question. I think Peter's absolutely right that, you know, without a national strategy, and given kind of how cases are just kind of exponentially growing across the country, in a sense, it is inevitable in that sense. Like, we're not an island, as we've said many times. As the Bay Area can do everything exactly right, and we're always going to be vulnerable to what's happening, you know, even in the next county over or the next state over, you know, on the East Coast, whatever. And so there's an aspect of that. But that being said, you know, in fact, when I was talking with Dr. Nick Moss, the Alameda County Health Officer today, you know, he basically was saying, yes, this is here. We can't really prevent the next wave from coming. We can't prevent a surge. What we can do, and what the Bay Area has proven very capable of doing, is protecting our healthcare infrastructure, keeping these surges from really overwhelming our region and becoming, you know, just really devastating. We still have, you know, basically the lowest fatality rates of pretty much anywhere. San Francisco still has the lowest fatality rate of any major city in the country, which is, that's huge. I mean, that's kind of your end game, right? Is you want to keep deaths as low as possible. And that's still the case. We're still doing well with that. We've never had a crisis in our hospital system. We've always kind of kept those numbers in check. And we've used this time, you know, when cases have been lower, to really keep kind of cushioning, keep supporting our healthcare structure so that, you know, if we do see that really sharp increase, that we'll be ready to handle it. So I think each time we see these upticks, which, as you said, I mean, they are inevitable that we're going to see these waves. We're kind of tested. Is this going to be the time when maybe we fail? Maybe our best efforts just aren't good enough. But, you know, I feel like we're still in good shape. And I'm certainly not at this point overly concerned about, will we be able to handle this kind of next wave? I do think that the holidays, the cold weather, you know, the flu season, there's going to be a lot of things that test us even more than ever before in the coming months. So certainly I think there's cause for alarm.
So, but this time around, we know more because we've lived with this virus now for many months. And so perhaps even if the number of infections continues to increase, we know how to treat this better than we did back in February and March. But Peter, looking to the silver lining in all of this, well, not silver lining, but more sort of the optimistic side of things, there was also huge news on the vaccine front. Last week, we learned about Pfizer's vaccine being over 90% effective. And just this morning, news broke that early data shows that the Moderna vaccine is close to 95% effective. Those effective rates seem almost too good to be true. What do you make of them?
I am so excited, Pache. I mean, I think many of us were, you know, it was too good to be true, like you said. But also, you know, it's using a new platform that hadn't been used before in terms of vaccines technology, the mRNA vaccine. So the fact that you can get such a large proportion of folks on vaccine, you know, being not having COVID is truly remarkable. The devil will be in the details, though, with distribution. And but it is really good news.
So you really feel like this is something that we can trust. And is this vaccine for everybody? Or are there certain populations for whom this is not a good thing?
But right now, I think it's for everyone. The Pfizer group didn't release subgroup analyses, but Moderna in their press release did say that, you know, it looked very, very good in the elderly population as well as in diverse populations. So I think, you know, when they come to the FDA for the EUA, they will release very detailed data. And again, as the full trial becomes accrued, we'll get more subgroup analyses. But so far, so good. Other vaccine companies are also looking at specific populations like HIV-infected patients and, you know, younger individuals, kids. So I think all of that together will give us a more robust picture of subgroup efficacy as well.
So you mentioned that these vaccines work differently than other types of vaccines for other diseases, and that might have something to do with why these numbers look so much better than any of us could have expected. How about the vaccines head-to-head? Do they work the same way, or are they different? And how does that play into which one gets used?
That's a great question. So at the end of the day, they all act in a very similar way, which is to present a piece of the virus, which is the spike protein, to the body. And the body says, hey, this is not part of me. This is a foreign particle, and I'll develop antibodies against it. So the fact that Moderna and Pfizer have been successful speaks not only to mRNA, but the use of the spike protein in stimulating the body to make antibodies. because the other vaccines, AstraZeneca, J&J, use a vector, and that vector is a sort of like a weakened virus, adenovirus that brings the genetic instructions to the cells to make these spike proteins. But at the end of the day, the body sees the spike protein, makes antibodies. So we think that they will also be effective.
And how many doses are we talking about here?
We're talking about two doses, at least in the Pfizer vaccine, spaced 3 weeks apart. Some of them will be spaced 2 weeks apart. So that also presents another challenge in terms of rollout, which is tracking. So say you were in San Francisco, you got the first dose, but you went to LA to visit your family around the time of your second dose. Some massive IT support system will have to track folks to make sure they've gotten it in the right time.
Right. And what if you go beyond 2 or 3 weeks? Do you have to start all over again? Lots of questions to be answered. I also understand that the Pfizer vaccine has some concerns around storage, meaning I think that it has to be kept at a very, 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 very cold temperature. Is that right?
Yes, it's really, really cold. So negative 70 degrees Celsius for the Pfizer vaccine and negative 20 degrees Celsius for the Moderna vaccine. So, you know, it may be easier to roll out the Moderna vaccine, but they don't have quite the capacity as Pfizer. Pfizer has two production facilities, one in Europe, one in the U.S. Moderna is really based in Boston. It's kind of like a homegrown group, although they're really going to ramp up their distribution. And to give listeners some perspective, the deep freeze in your home refrigerator is probably negative 8 degrees Celsius.
Wow. So a lot colder, which means stocking refrigerators that can go that low, power supplies, stability of the vaccine as it's being moved from the refrigerator to the syringe to the person and so on. Lots of logistical issues to be dealt with here. And is this going to be a one course and done, or do we see this being added to the flu vaccine in years to come?
That's a great question. No one really knows. But the good news for the general population is that we have, you know, at least in each trial for phase three, 40,000 or so people who will be followed very closely. And they have a head start from us in at least 6 months or so. So we will use that data in terms of antibody waning to determine whether or not and if a booster should be given. But most experts think that for the mRNA vaccines anyway, maybe it will be a year, maybe 2 years, but most folks think you may need a booster.
All right. And so what does this mean for other vaccines in development? Do you think those are going to continue apace, or are those companies sort of waiting to see what happens with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines?
It's going to be really interesting to see how the other companies position themselves. In the beginning, everyone will have a fair shot because it's just really a numbers game. We have to immunize as many people in a shorter period as possible. So, you know, as long as they meet some metric, and we can go into that, they're going to be used. And maybe folks won't have a choice of which product they get. It's just a matter of what's available. After the dust settles and in terms of boosting, then people will think about, you know, maybe things like refrigeration or, you know, whether or not you need one shot or two shots. And these are other things that are being explored by the other companies.
So how soon can we see a vaccine available to people in San Francisco or the Bay Area,
well,
for that matter?
I think it's going to be in a tiered system. So, you know, the first rollout will be in healthcare workers and first responders. Pfizer says it'll have, you know, about, I think, something like in the order of 40 million vaccines, that's 20 million people by the end of 2020. And Moderna says it will have, you know, about 20 million vaccines. So, but to give perspective, California probably has about 2 million folks in that category. And if California gets 1 million, that's still not enough to vaccinate everyone in the first year.
And we're just talking about California. We're not talking about the rest of the country or the rest of the world. So lots of issues there on scaling this up and making sure that the distribution is equitable. Turning back to you, Aaron, of course, all of this is wonderful, but it's only effective if people line up to get the vaccine. and I'm going back here to September. That's a long time ago. I get it. But the Pew Research Center surveyed people around their possible distrust of a coronavirus vaccine, and only 51% of those surveyed at that time said that they would definitely or probably get a vaccine to prevent COVID. Now that we have some more actual candidates, do you think that's still the case? Have you been hearing about any follow-up polling that suggests that people are more warming up to this idea?
I have not heard of any follow-up polling, but I will say most of the folks I talked to say that there's a couple of really positive signs. One is if these vaccines do prove to be 90 to 95% effective, I mean, that makes a big difference in terms of, you know, the percentage uptick you need. If you have a vaccine that's only 50% effective, you need to have pretty much everybody on board to get, you know, herd immunity. If it's 90%, that kind of gives you a little bit more wiggle room in there. But also, I think, you know, we have to keep in mind that that polling was taking place when there was so much being talked about in terms of, you know, President Trump pushing to, you know, accelerating this vaccine ahead of time, that there were questions about, you know, was it going to be a safe and secure process? You know, would people be able to feel confident? I feel like, you know, we're going to have certainly over the next, you know, several months it takes to manufacture these, you know, whatever vaccines become available, there's going to be a massive public health campaign to really tell people, you know, how safe this is, why they should do it, and just get that information out. And, you know, presumably we'll have a different president by January, you know, with a different plan and a kind of a different message to folks about it. So I think there's a lot to feel optimistic about on that front. So that being said, you know, there certainly is an uphill battle in terms of getting the number of people on board that we need.
And Peter, what do you think the messaging should be from public health officials, politicians, others, that's going to help push through some of this resistance to getting vaccinated?
You know, that's a really tough question, Pache. I think that it's really going to be difficult, just speaking from my own experience with patients in the clinic, you know, because it's so multi-hued. You know, you think about the legacy of, you know, using you know, it's frankly, diverse populations for natural history studies that we talked about, the HPV cell lines. And many patients who have talked to us still hesitant for those reasons. They say things like, you know, I don't want to be a guinea pig. I'd wait for somebody else to do it. I'd wear my mask and stay at home. So I think a lot needs to be done. The first step was really ensuring that more participants than not traditionally were in trials were from diverse populations. The secondly is trying to have the people going out in the community to be from the community themselves. So I think that will be, you know, another step in the right direction. But I hope that we can all work together and reach people where they are. It's not great to lecture them and say, you must get a vaccine, but to really figure out why they have hesitancy and then work around through that. I don't think it's going to be an easy solution.
So that's the road that's several weeks to months ahead of us. Let's talk next week, Aaron. Thanksgiving Day, you mentioned it. The Thanksgiving Day weekend is upon us. What are health officials saying we should do, or more importantly, not do, so that we can keep ourselves and everyone around us safe?
Right. Well, I will say that the messaging has become pretty urgent in the last week or so that people really, really not do the big Thanksgiving celebration. In the past, it had been sort of, you know, advising, please don't do this or reconsider, keep it, you know. Now it's more like, seriously, guys, don't travel. Don't have celebrations with people outside of your immediate household. Just don't do it. There's not sort of this messaging around how to do it safely. The message is just, you know, keep it very small. Keep it with your household, and, you know, hopefully everybody stays safe so that you can reschedule it for 2021.
And Peter, what would you add to that?
Well, I'd say that, you know, it's really, really tough. Again, this is moving so fast. Last week, if you had asked me that question, I'd probably have more, be more ambivalent about people's need for travel, particularly, you know, to see relatives and so on. But again, like Aaron was saying, my recommendations have become more austere by the day and seeing the numbers. However, I do think that, you know, if there is a reason for someone to see a relative who can't live to see the next holiday, it might be something that on an individual level, someone might think about.
But always make sure to wear a mask and wash your hands and stay as far apart, up to at least 6 feet apart if you can. Those things remain.
Definitely.
Well, I want to wish the both of you a good Thanksgiving break. And thanks so much for always being at the ready to come and break this very complicated information down for us. Aaron Alday and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, Aaron Alday of the San Francisco Chronicle and Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UCSF. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Peter. Good to hear your voice.
And same here, Aaron. It's like a reunion. I loved it. Of course, with Pache, too.
Next up, I'll be talking to Alexandra Kennan of Urban Hiker SF. This is City Visions. Stay with us.
Duty is educated. She not the type to fool around or be manipulated. She got a strong sense of pride, no need for validation. She is a goddess all her own, shaking off them haters. She's shaking off them haters. Ooh, child, she's amazing. Her body. Shining bright just like the stars when they are miles away. Cause baby, she's a queen.
Welcome back to City Visions. This is Joseph Pache. Our next guest, Alexandra Kennan, founder of Urban Hiker SF, has been walking the Bay Area since she arrived here in 2007. The author of Urban Trails San Francisco and Urban Trails East Bay, she recently embarked on a project to document all the outdoor stairways in San Francisco. We're happy to have her join us to share with us what she has found and maybe inspire us to explore our urban landscapes as we're being encouraged to go and search the great outdoors for fun and connection. Welcome, Alexandra Kennan.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're quite welcome. So tell us, how did you come up with this idea to index the stairways of San Francisco?
Well, I have always been fascinated with San Francisco's stairways since I moved here, as you said, in 2007. When I moved here, my dad had given me a copy of Ada Bakalinsky's Stairway Walks in San Francisco. It is a classic.
What you can't see, listeners, is the fact that I'm over Zoom.
I'm
holding up the book. And
It's kind of a San Francisco Bible for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And my dad gifted that to me, and it really changed my life. So it gave me a framework for exploring San Francisco. But, of course, when I moved here, I had one of these jobs that was down on the peninsula, and I really rarely spent any time in San Francisco during daylight hours. So I'd explore on weekends. But more recently, I've been exploring more of San Francisco, especially through hiking and stairways, since 2012 when I left the big corporate job.
So with all of the beauty of nature just minutes away by car, what drew you to focus on stairways within urban areas? You talk about San Francisco, but you also published a book about hikes in the East Bay.
Yes. Yeah, so what is it about stairways? Well, they just, you know, they're not completely unique to San Francisco. There are other great stairway cities, you know, Portland and Seattle and Pittsburgh, namely, to name a few, but I just find them really interesting. They're a really interesting way to get around. They kind of change your path. So you're walking down a street, all of a sudden you see this interesting thing alongside you, and you want to climb up and see the view from the top or the bottom.
So how many have you counted so far?
Well, I have my spreadsheet up, and I think there's over 1,000. So I have written about over 1,000 in my spreadsheet, which I can tell everyone the link later. And I myself have seen and documented 934.
Wow.
And yeah, to answer your question and before, you know, this all kind of started around coronavirus. So we had this stay-at-home order and, you know, don't get in your car, don't go too far. So I really just started walking around the neighborhoods around me. I live in the Mission. Even right in Dolores Heights, Castro area, there are some fantastic walks I went on, and I saw all these stairways. I'm like, you know what? This is going to be what I do during COVID. I'm going to see all of San Francisco stairways.
So are there criteria for what counts as a stairway, like a minimum number of steps?
Oh my goodness. This is a good question because I did recently find a stairway with one step and I was like, come on, do I count this? But I do. So one step all the way to, you know, let's say the Filbert and Greenwich Street steps have, you know, around 380 steps. So
how many steps in the Lion Staircase, if that's what it's called?
Oh, that's like around 224. So there's two flights of 62 and then like 15 flights of 8, something like that. If you can do the math on that, I think it's around 224, something like that.
So I want to just put out the phone number in case listeners want to join our conversation tonight and talk about their favorite staircase walks or hikes in the Bay Area to give each other some ideas for what to do in the coming weeks as we enter the holiday season and we're being encouraged not to gather indoors. So give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can send us an email at cityvisions@kalw.org. We're talking with Alexandra Kennan. She's the author of Urban Trails San Francisco and Urban Trails East Bay. Again, 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255. We're also on Twitter at City Visions KALW. All right. So now, which are your favorites?
Oh, there's so many. Well, of course, now I've discovered there are 11, I believe, mosaic stairways in the city. If there are more than 11, let me know. But those are always just so beautiful to see. And I know people love doing things on social media, so they're always fun to take photos of too. You know, Lion Street steps, as you mentioned, of course, that's a classic. And there's some lesser known ones too. There's one right by Mount Davidson called Bengal Alley, and it was transformed from a hillside that had seen better days into a really gorgeous stairway. And I don't even believe there's a street sign on this one, so you really have to be looking for it.
Wow, it's like a treasure hunt, literally.
It is.
So we mentioned that the stairways vary in the number of steps. What if someone just wanted to just get started, where would you send them?
Well, I have a few places I'd send them. Definitely get Ada Bakalinsky's Stairway Walks in San Francisco. You mentioned my books too. There is a chapter on kind of stairway walks in there. And then I would tell them about my public stairway map, which I created on Google Maps using the My Maps feature. And the link is bit.ly/sfstairmap. And that has a map of all the stairways I know about so far. And what I would do is I would pick a neighborhood. I'd zoom in on my map, pick a neighborhood, let's say Russian Hill. And I might just start from there, kind of say, I want to explore these, you know, every stairway is marked by a map pin. I want to look at these 10 map pins and I'll make a route out of it. Maybe I can find a 2-mile, 3-mile route to connect all these map pins. And I'd start from there. So those are a few ways to get started.
That sounds really great. We have a message here from Koila in San Francisco asking which stairway has the most steps in San Francisco. Do you know that?
You know, I'm don't quote me on this, but I do think it's probably the Filbert or Greenwich Street steps. And I do think one of them has 383 steps. So that would be going all the way down from, you know, sea level all the way up to Coit Tower.
Yeah.
With multiple flights.
With gyms going from 50% capacity to 25% capacity, there's your Stairmaster right there.
That is how I get my workouts. I've really never belonged to a gym since I've lived here. It's really great for working out.
And do you have any recommendations for like the most offbeat or just off-path one where you kind of actually have to travel quite a bit to get to? But it's
honestly
worth it?
I mean, gosh, there are so many, you know, let's say on my stair map and in my spreadsheet, which is bit.ly/sfstairsheet, I rank these stairways by their beauty. And this is, of course, subjective. So, of course, you know, there will be people who may disagree with me. But on the map, if you're just looking at the map, the red map pins are the most beautiful stairways. You know, and that's a combination of setting. It's a combination of how many stairs they have, whether it's a mosaic. I think of the red map pins as I would leave my neighborhood and travel 45 minutes all the way across San Francisco to see the stairway. So that's the metric. One of these I just found, I was just doing, I took a week off from work recently and I did a great walk around Bayview. And there is a street called Quesada Street, and there is a beautiful mosaic stairway made of tiles that children have painted. There's a mural alongside the stairway, and the whole street has been architected and landscaped to be beautiful. There's mini stairways, little mini ones connecting two sides of the street. So there's an upper and a lower Quesada, and the stairways connect those. So there's not only the gorgeous mosaic stairway, there's many, many, many stairways along the way. There's a lending library, and then, yeah, that mural. That one I would go across town for sure. That was a new one for me, so a little off the beaten path.
Wow. And what's the most interesting thing you encountered on a stairway?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. You know, what I find the most interesting thing for me is how well these are used. So what I want to do in my project is document the stairways. So first of all, I put them on a map, I put them in a spreadsheet, and I take photos of them. And even the ones in the middle of nowhere, there's usually someone, I'm trying to take a picture of a plain stairway, there's usually someone on them. So they're not just decorative at all. They're like, these are used, they are kind of really arteries and veins that bring our people throughout San Francisco. So yeah, that was really surprising for me. Even the really off the beaten path ones, I'm like, why are there five people on the stairway? So
We're speaking with Alexandra Kennan, founder of Urban Hiker SF and author of Urban Trails San Francisco and Urban Trails East Bay. If you'd like to call in with a favorite urban hike or any other hike in the Bay Area, give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So let's go to Zoe. Zoe, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Yeah, Hi. Zoe, where are you calling from?
I'm from San Francisco, and my favorite stairway walk is from Ada Valinsky Stairway Walks, and it's the Buena Vista Heights Park one. And my favorite stairway is on the back of the Randall Museum, and it takes you to the top of Corona Heights Park for a really beautiful view.
Wow, so you kind of string together three stairways there. Thanks so much.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I believe it's actually more than three stairways.
Oh, wow.
It even takes you down to the Castro.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for sharing that.
No problem.
Zoe's comment made me think, Alexandra, are you is this like spreadsheet available for crowdsourcing? Like people can go on and add stuff, or are you kind
that
of a control freak?
I am not I'm a control freak in that not everyone can edit the spreadsheet, but everyone can view the spreadsheet and map. And I would love this to be a collaborative effort for all, you know, something bringing us together when we can't be together in person. So if anyone goes to my map, goes to my spreadsheet, or, you know, just thinks there's a stairway I don't know about, I'd love them to contact me, and I will add their pins to the map, and I will add that stairway info to the sheet. And if they have a photo, I will give them a photo credit on the map and the spreadsheet.
Wonderful. So your fiance has also been working on a fitness project during the pandemic. You're talking about using the staircases as a way to stay fit. Tell us what that's about.
He is, you know, way more intense than I am. He has decided to run every single, not only street, but every trail, every alleyway in San Francisco. And I can't even remember how many miles it is. Probably it's over 1,500 miles of streets and stairways. Other people have done this. I've encountered them on social media. But yeah, Brett, in his traditional extreme style, runs not at all week. And then he runs, you know, anywhere between 10 and 15 miles on Saturday and Sunday.
Wow. Well, good luck to him. I imagine people could walk those streets too, right? They don't have to run.
You can walk them too. Absolutely. And what really motivates him is, he's doing a lot of this for the Black Lives Matter movement. He may want to do a fundraising effort at some point. He hasn't put that part together yet, but he is motivated on making sure that everyone can run or walk freely and safely.
Wonderful. We have a comment and a question from John from San Francisco asking if the city is doing enough to maintain and preserve the stairways. What shape are they in?
In general, many of them are in decent shape. There is one that I got to tell you, I absolutely loved that was closed in probably 2012, 2013. That one is called Acme Alley. and it's been closed off. There's literally a fence at the bottom of it. But many of the stairways I've seen, aside from trash, which we can all do a better job about picking up, they have been in good shape. A funny story I'll tell you is I was doing some research on Alta Plaza's park's stairways, and there was a movie, What's Up, Doc, from the 70s that was shot there, where you should watch this on YouTube. There's a car chase where four cars go down the stairs. Those are permanently, you know, damaged from that car chase. But they actually, besides that, a lot of them have been in very good shape.
Yes, I do remember that scene, What's Up, Doc, with Barbara Streisand.
Yes, that one.
Yes. So let's move to the East Bay. You wrote a book, a companion book to your your Urban Trails, San Francisco Urban Trails East Bay. So for our East Bay listeners, or for people in San Francisco and other parts of the Bay Area who want to cross a bridge or take a tube under the bay, tell us about some of the hidden gems in the East Bay.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, I don't think a lot of people, if they take a vacation or a day trip to Oakland, they're probably not doing it for the hiking trails. But one of my favorite trails is right in the middle of Oakland. It's in the Diamond Park. And that park, I would tell people not to do it necessarily in fall after there's been rains, because you actually cross a creek bed. So you walk through a creek bed as your trail. So do it in the dry season. And you end up in a big redwood grove. And it's just an amazing city park that I never would have known about if I hadn't done this book. And of course, in Oakland, there's Redwood Regional Park, if you love redwoods. You know, as our days get shorter, I just find redwoods are a great place to seek solace. So that's another park I definitely recommend to people.
Wow. And so far what I've heard is that getting on a staircase is great because it's exercise. It gets you to different parts of the city. You get to observe the city from different vantage points. How crowded have these staircases been? I'm sure there's a lot of people who are concerned about, you know, being in crowded spaces. And a staircase can obviously narrow one's path.
That is a great point. I haven't run into too many problems, and luckily, thank you, fellow San Franciscans, for wearing your masks. I felt very comfortable on these stairways. I've not been to high traffic stairways like the Lion Street steps. You know, on a Saturday morning, there's usually a line to run up them and some boot camps on the top. So I might say, you know, you might want to avoid Filbert, Greenwich, Lion at prime times. But if you're going there on, you know, a Monday, Tuesday night, you're probably fine. And I have not really encountered any problems with distancing on the stairways myself.
All right, let's go to another caller here. Steve from San Francisco.
Hey,
welcome to the program.
Guys, this is a great show, especially timely. I used to belong to SF Walks, and they used to do 17 hills and parks, and it would be all across town. And so I kept the thing kind of in my head in the route sheet, and now do parts of it. So like Pemberton Steps, which is so
perfect.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so when Muni was going, you could start out at Catherine and kind of do that loop up and through Mount Sutro, then come down on the backside of UCSF. And then also, the interesting thing was I saw all these parks, and I heard these stories like Mount Olympus Park and the steps that go up to there, and you really see some interesting parts of the city, which was especially good because I didn't grow up here, so I could kind of explore these different areas of it.
Well, thanks so much, Steve, for sharing those with us. So we got to wrap up this segment, although I'd love to keep talking about this. So tell us where people can find out more about your Stairways Project, your books, and your other work.
Yes, absolutely. A great place to start is my website, urbanhikersf.com. The stairway map is bit.ly/sfstairmap. The spreadsheet is bit.ly/sfstairsheet. And if you can't find anything and all these resources that you missed the links, just contact me at info@urbanhikersf.com. that email inbox gets forwarded to my inbox.
And we'll put that at the KLW website and on our Twitter feed. So thanks so much for joining us, Alexandra Kennan of Urban Hiker SF, and for giving us ideas of how to get outdoors in the weeks and months ahead.
Thanks for having me. It's been really fun.
Next up, City Vision's guest contributor, Sarah Ladipo Manyika, will speak with artist and curator Karen Seneferu.
So up alone, mind like a house of mirrors, let me take you to the next room. Used to cringe at my reflection, used to let the evil eye defy. Now I make them go blind to the shine. Got away with words, I get it from my pops. From the eye that worries, slave vampires and buckshots of blood clots. They say I'm too hot, got them congregating like ginger fires at coffee shops. Unruly, don't get close, watch me like a movie, but I am playing roles. Pretty used to getting me mud, I don't care if people like me cause the bank does. Fear for clowns, I don't know where my head was. In the clouds, they want to take me down, want to take me out. Rose on the third day, took a different route. Tongue tied, naysayers, what they talking about? That's blasphemy, don't be the last to see. Black woman is God, call it Elohim. Elohim, black woman is God, call it Elohim.
Hey there, Sarah.
I'm interrupting you.
No, you're not. But so you just heard God Talk by Madlines, one of the artists featured in the exhibition, The Black Woman is God, Reclaim, Reconfigure, Re-Remember. And this is where you come in, Sarah, and speak with Karen Seneferu.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm pleased to be joined now with Karen Seneferu, who's an artist, activist, project lead, and co-curator for the exhibit, which is currently showing at Somme Arts and opening soon at the African American Art and Culture Complex, as well as online. Welcome, Karen Seneferu.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
So, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with The Black Woman is God, can you explain what it is and the idea behind it?
Absolutely. Well, The Black Woman is God, this is our seventh year, our third year at Somme Arts Gallery. And the exhibition really is about challenging Eurocentric or cultural narratives about divinity and that are oftentimes exclusively white and male. And we wanted to push back against that narrative and look at the ways that Black women have championed social justice issues in contemporary American society, and also explore the intersectionality of race, age, and gender in a patriarchal construction of Black femininity.
So Karen, you spoke about divinity. Tell us, what was the genesis of the exhibition's name?
Well, I mean, it really came about with a conversation I had with the co-curator who at the time was the curator of the African American Art and Cultural Complex, or the AAACC, Melora Green, who is now the executive co-executive director there, when Mayor London Breed was the executive director. Both of them had asked me to do a solo show there, and I wasn't really interested in doing that. I really wanted to create a space that I had become familiar with, which was designed by Ray Louise Hayward, who had produced annually an exhibition called The Art of Living Black, where I had never seen 100 Black artists in one space, and a number of them being Black women. You know, at the time, I wasn't an artist, or I didn't see myself as an artist. And I was so struck by, you know, being in a space where I could see over 100 pieces of artwork by Black people in the Bay Area, that by the time I started producing art myself, inspired by these artists, Melora asked me, you know, just in a conversation, like, you know, why do you think Black women can push through so many struggles and challenges? And I said, well, you know why. The Black woman is God. And I just kind of said it, you know, without really thinking about, you know, you know, the cultural context of it. It was just something I blurted out. And at that moment, Laura said, well, that's going to be the title of the exhibition. Yeah. And so we really moved from this desire of having an individual space to a more collective space, particularly of artists who had influenced me and shaped me into becoming an artist.
Right. So you've highlighted this ability of pushing through struggle. And I wonder how you would place this year's exhibition in the context of the national conversation that's been had around racial justice in a year that's been filled with so much pain.
Well, I think, every year that the Black Womanist God has been at SOM Arts, there's always been killings. There's always been killings of Black people. And usually it's right around the time that our exhibition has taken place. So for a number of the Black women artists that are in the exhibition, they are really looking at how art can become a vehicle to heal, or how art can become a language of resistance, or how art can become a reimagining of the self beyond victimization. And so, this year isn't any different, because every year Black people in the society are struggling to maintain their own cultural identity against a landscape of various institutionalized forms of oppression. And with a desire not to internalize that, art becomes one of those tools of resistance. And so, you know, one of the things I like to say is that art is resistance to annihilation. And what I mean by that is that art is art, beauty and art and culture for me are all intersections of identity.
So healing, I also get the sense that there's celebration there as well.
Oh, without a doubt. Jubilation is definitely one of the components of the exhibition. Sorry about that. Family's coming in the house. So it happens with these Zoom gatherings. I'm actually in an interview right now.
I think they must have heard the word celebration.
Yes. And everyone's in the house is an artist. So, usually we have in the exhibition dance performance, and, 2,500 people have come out to these exhibitions. But this year we had to pivot to a virtual space. So how do you create jubilation? How do you create celebration? And that's done through, the virtual reception that we had November 13th with, dance performances by Colette Iloi, and this year we had Turfin 24/7, three young Black men, Levi Allen, Chris Jones, and Brandon Butler, who I have known for about 10 years and saw them dancing on the streets and brought them into the space. Mm-hmm. And having, artists talk about, like people like Renee Cox and Harmonia Rosales, who are, really luminaries in the art world, really talking about the joy of claiming one's body, claiming one's artistic presence in the artwork. And are having Professor Renoko Rashidi, who's a scholar of African history, really giving presence to what it means to know oneself through creativity, through history, through culture. All of that becomes a place of healing. All of that becomes an engagement and joy. And so this year we had Renee Makata create a video called God Code with Ryan Nicole and Mad Lines and Cheyenne and Talia Taylor and Coco Palia. And these artists are young MCs. They're beautiful. They're creative. They're strong. They're dynamic. they're taking over the streets with their music in the video. And so all of that's just very engaging.
So you've given us some great names there. And as you're talking about dancing in the streets, I'm thinking about our earlier conversations about stairways. Stairways may be hard to dance on them, but that would add another lovely little twist. Karen, your exhibition has always included conversations, performances, and artwork. So I'm wondering, how has it changed this year with in-person events being limited due to the coronavirus?
Well, I mean, this was a major pivot for us. Thankfully we were, I've had these two very strong supporters and been a part of the project, and that's Ayana Ivory and Idris Hassan. Ayana introduced me to Renee Makata, who has a production studio, and she really assisted us in getting a number of these in-person performances on video, and that was just really a wonderful transition. And then having the dance performances being presented through video, and then having the artist talks. We were very fortunate to have luminaries such as Greg Tate, who wrote for the Village Voice and Billboard and other prestigious magazines in New York, music and art magazines, and also Danny Simmons, who owns a gallery in Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. And, he's an artist. He's a curator, been in the art industry for a long time. And then also Dwayne Ditterville and my husband, Malik Snefro. I mean, these are giants within their communities, but also outside of it. And just having them hold a live conversation and talk about what it means for Black men to value Black women artists, both in the music industry as well as visual arts, and the long historical contribution that Black women have had. This became a very engaging practice for the audience that were watching it on YouTube and Facebook and Instagram. So I think that the love and the dedication for the project really transferred in this new medium. And, I was nervous about it, but in some ways we were still able to translate that cultural need that engages people right. from all over the country that comes to our exhibition now became a global demonstration.
Great. So where can our listeners find information about how to view the exhibition or attend any of the events?
Great. Well, we have a TBWIG television channel on YouTube where the virtual reception still lives. And you can also connect to our website, www.theblackwomanisgod.com. And check out our workshops are going to be coming up in December. Artist talks. We're going to have Bobby Cesperez in December. We're having Zap Mama with Destiny Muhammad and Tariqa Lewis. We're going to have artist talks, workshops. And also, please check out our GoFundMe. We want to be able to support these people. A number of them are, are dedicated to the project, but
so Karen, I'm gonna just rudely interrupt you because we have to wrap it up, but we've got all that information. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Karen Seneferu. Now back to you, Joseph.
Thanks, Sarah. It's great to have you live with us. That was City Vision's guest contributor, Sarah Ladipo Manyika, speaking with Karen Seneferu. And that's City Visions for this evening. Thanks to all of our guests. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was the mighty D Minor. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Wendy Holcomb, and our guest contributor was Sarah Ladipo Manyika. We're off next week for the Thanksgiving holiday. Join us again live on Monday, November 30th at 6 p.m. Our closing music tonight is a clip from a piece created by Zap Mama, Tariqa Lewis, and Destiny Muhammad for The Black Woman is God. I'm Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Be well and be safe.